going to read our first two passages for today, Mark 9, 36 and 37, and thank you, children, for being here for this part, and Matthew 18, verse 3. Jesus took a little child, whom he placed among them. Taking the child in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me." He also said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Thank you, children. You may return to your parents, and I invite Pastor Blaine to come and give us some thoughts on growing.
So, what is it about children? And does Jesus have any idea what he is talking about? When he said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven," sounds like it might be more akin to children adorably dressed for a Sunday morning or for a Christmas pageant than what kids are really like most days. Does Jesus have any idea? Did Jesus ever have kids? Does Jesus know about the terrible twos? Do Palestinian kids go through them as well as English kids? Does Jesus know about mess diapers and sass and the attention span of a gnat? Is Jesus aware of their embarrassingly lack of social skills, like our grandson Judah marching up to a perfect stranger at Walmart and announcing his name and his September birth date and asking them straight away why their teeth are crooked? "What is wrong with your teeth?" seemed his point of interest to Judah the child. Does Jesus know about these things when he says to the adults in the crowd, "Unless you change, unless you become like one of these children, you will never find your way into the kingdom of heaven"? So what is it about children? What if you asked a parent of five of them? What if you asked a school teacher of 23 of them? Or a social worker or a judge about children? Would their report be the same as Jesus's? Mary Pat is a dear friend of ours, and she was raised in the Catholic tradition, and she went to Catholic school run by some very strict nuns who, according to Mary Pat, were more interested in straight lines than in learning. Line up to come into the school. Line up again to attend morning mass across the street at the church. Line up to come back across from the church to the school. Line up for recess. Line up to come in from recess. Line up at the water fountain. Line up for lunch. Line up to leave school. Line up or else see the sudden swat of a ruler if you step out of that line or hear the verbal threat that disobedient children might end up in hell. Mary Pat laughs about it now. But you never forget such things, the threats, the fears thrust upon you at an early age. Hell happened to be my sister's first concern when her divorce was pending. Hell threats are hard to live down. Now, maybe it was an era, and maybe the pendulum of structure and discipline has now swung too far the other way. Who knows about these things? But I do remember the first grade day when a little boy in our class broke ranks and came walking back out of the boys' room sequence of line to show the teacher a bug he'd found and then felt the sharp, rude slap of a pointer on his hand that held that bug. And he cried his way back into the boys' room. And it makes you wonder if the nuns and that staunchly religious first grade teacher had ever heard what Jesus said, "Unless you become one of these children." And so, yeah, what is it about children? Now, for sure, last week's Grammy camp with our five grandchildren is a small sample size. It is. It is a one-week getaway and not a full year of child rearing. It is not. But at Grammy camp, the rules around food and bedtimes do relax a little bit, and And you do get to see things you wouldn't normally see, children things. Like Leish, who is from the Indiana flatlands, take out his camera in the car and begin snapping mountain photos as we ascended Tuscarora Ridge. And once again, the camera came out at Big Mountain Overlook, wanting to capture the splendor of the hills and the valleys that he does not get to see back home, a certain kind of awestruck marvel at his surroundings. And could that be what Jesus meant about a child, that adults could use a larger dose of awestruck marvel? And one morning, Eliza came down to the morning campfire with a fistful of flashcards, and she began quizzing me on state capitals, and then state birds, and then state nicknames, all before breakfast, because Eliza has a thirst to know things and to pass them on. She will watch how-to videos by the dozen to learn crafty know-hows, and then go off and create them, because that is the way Eliza is. She wants to know things, and she wants to create things. And could that be what Jesus meant to be as a little child? The thirst to know things and to create beautiful things. And do adults ever stop their learning and creating? Why do adults shut down? On the ride up from Winchester, Eliza and Isis were riding in the back seat of our car and listening to Eliza's choice of music, and who knows where the question came from. If it was the lyrics to the current song of the pop song that was playing on the radio, if it was their fertile imaginations at work in the back seat, or if the time was now opportune, what with Pop-Pop Pastor driving that car. But the question came up, Pop-Pop, is God a man or a woman? And I said, well, you know, no one has ever seen God, so we might have to wait and see. And that seemed enough for them, enough for now, anyway. And could that be what Jesus meant about a child, that questions will come quite naturally to them, and they will ask them, a plethora of them at age two, not so many in adulthood. Why do adults seem to shut down the questions? I would like for us to hear again these last four sentences from the Bible book we call Jonah. Now, believe me, there is an important and large drama going on in this short Bible book. There is. But I'm not concerned with any of the Jonah and big fish drama this morning. Not so much. Instead, this time, let's put on our grammar goggles. Listen for how it ends, grammatically, how it ends. Listen for the punctuation ending.
Then God said to Jonah, what right do you have to get angry about this shade tree? Jonah said, plenty of right. It made me angry enough to die. God said, what's this? How is it that you can change your feelings from pleasure to anger overnight about a mere shade tree that you did nothing to get? You neither planted nor watered it. It grew up one night and died the next. So, why can't I likewise change what I feel about Nineveh from anger to pleasure? This big city of more than 120,000 childlike people who didn't yet know right from wrong, to say nothing of all the innocent animals.
There are 66 books in the Bible. 65 of those end with a dot. A period. One of them ends with a question mark. We just heard it. Jonah ends with a question, and no tidy answer is given. Not there. And remember what we said earlier about children. They have them. They have their questions, a plethora of them. And by the time we're adults, many of us are no longer in the mood for questions anymore. And does that stunt our growth? There is a proverb, Proverbs 25:2 to be exact, which says, it is the glory of God to conceal things, but the glory of kings to search them out. And maybe literally we would write ourselves off because we are not, shall we say, kings, nor are we queens, but the truth of the proverb still stands. The glory of God is to conceal things. It is our glory to search them out. And could that be what Jesus meant about being like a child, to be delightfully inquisitive? inquisitive, to be like Eliza, who wants to know things and asks them. If you've been around here, you know for the last couple of months now, we have been doing a kind of treasure hunt. We have been taking an extended look into what it means to follow the way of Jesus. And for those who might be following the way of Jesus out of fear, those persons will walk with a certain amount of trepidation, as if faith were like some kind of minefield, and we do not want to take any missteps lest God blow us to smithereens, and that would hurt. It has been observed, especially by educators, that somewhere along the line between childhood and adulthood, we begin to lose our imaginations. We create less, we dream less often, we look back to the good old days more often than we look ahead. And for sure, we are not inclined to entertain questions very much, and educators especially, as Tina pointed out, educators especially are wondering why that is. Why do we put on the brakes and shut down as adults? Now, I did not grow up Catholic like our friend Mary Pat. I did not have nuns planting the fear of hell into me weekly. I heard few, if any, hellfire sermons in my growing up church. I did, however, grow up in the Mennonite world, and both of my Mennonite grandfathers had a rather dim view of higher education, and my grandmothers went along with whatever my grandfather said, so there's that. Almost all of my aunts and uncles stopped going to school after the eighth grade. But my oldest uncle once got wind of a three-week Bible course that was being held at EMC, and he wanted in the worst way to attend, but my grandfather would not allow it. It was thought he'd be better off at home working. And it was thought that their home church of Franconia Mennonite Church would have all the answers that he would ever need anyway. So it was a no-go for my uncle. And he eventually left the Mennonite church and sojourned with the Lutherans for the rest of his life. And he is now buried in their cemetery. We might call my uncle hitting a church dead end. We might even call it a church injury. I once heard an adult in my home church tell my rambunctious younger brother that he shouldn't be asking so many questions. Too many questions will be harmful to your faith. And that was some of my early church experience too. Believe what the church tells you, period. Do what the Bible tells you, period. Don't ask too many questions, period. It'll run your faith right off its rails. Really? For those of you who might be up for a good Bible challenge, try reading through one of the Gospels. Go ahead, pick your favorite, Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. Trace Jesus all the way through one of your favorite Gospels and spot how many times Jesus poses a question. Tally them up. And go ahead and see if Jesus supplies ready answers to his questions, or see how often Jesus lets his questions hang there. Well, I cheated a little. I Googled that very question, how many times Jesus asks a question. You know what number popped up? 307. In the Gospels, if you put all four of them together, Jesus asks a question 307 times. Like this one. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How would I answer that? How long would it take for that answer to come to me? How often do I judge others and leave myself off the hook? Does this have anything to do with church gossip? Jesus asks that question. Or like this one. Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? How would I answer that one? How long would it take for my answer to come? Or this question, for who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves at that table? What's my answer? How often do I serve someone else? See, Jesus does this kind of thing Not once, not twice, not three times, but 307 times. Well, then go ahead and flip the equation around. In the gospel book, see how many times someone comes asking Jesus the question. Apparently in the gospels, people ask Jesus a question 183 times. Guess how many of those 183 questions he clearly answers? Three. So, maybe if it's true that Jesus asks more questions than he answers, maybe we should get our church librarian, Jen, to order Martin Copenhaver's book on this matter, Jesus is the Question, when most of us would like to say Jesus is the Answer. Or maybe if Jesus, the Son of God, has a 307 comfort level with questions, maybe we can have that kind of comfort level too. Maybe Jesus is reluctant to answer our questions because it would ruin our search for the beauty of them, to search and grow. And could that be what Jesus meant about what a child is like? The freedom to trust in that the answers will come by looking for them, and that answers will sometimes take a while. We have one more scripture, and this one too is a rather famous one. It is from the book of Genesis. It is about Jacob in his all-night wrestling match, a story that is often illustrated in children's storybooks. But there are no children in this Jacob story, and so maybe we listen with our adult ears. Yeah, go ahead. Let's listen in.
Genesis 23, 24 to 31. So Jacob was left alone. A man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched and as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip.
High school wrestling matches go for 6 minutes, usually. College wrestling matches go for 8 minutes, give or take. Jacob's wrestling match is longer and comes away with a dislocated hip. And even with a dislocated hip, Jacob kept on going. He kept on wrestling, which I am guessing was a rather painful part of the match. If you look closely at a college wrestler, you will often notice, catch a glimpse of their funny-looking ears. It's called cauliflower ear. It's a malady that will not go away. Cauliflower ear is there for the rest of their lives. But for many wrestlers, it's more of a battle scar than a worry, so they keep on nonetheless. In the end, in a high school or college wrestling match, the referee raises the arm of the victor. Match over. This one is the winner. In Jacob's match, there is no referee. And the match did not end with a raised fist or the cheer of a crowd, but with a blessing, which is an odd way for a wrestling match to end. Jacob walks away from his match with a limp, which, who knows if it ever went away, if he limped for the rest of his life, but also he left with a blessing. Now, there is a line in this story that is worthy of our attention, our adult focus. It says that Jacob had striven with people. And I do not suppose it would take too much memory on our part to identify the people that we have striven with, the person we strive with, the persons we have strove with, the person for which we have striven. We all have them. That's not the hard part for us to get. We can recite their names, and we sometimes do. The part we are less likely to imagine is striving with God when we have been more conditioned to believe, like Mary Pat was taught, that we should do everything in our power to do the opposite, to not make God angry, to stay on God's good side, to stay in line, to toe that line, to keep our beliefs in line. Bible says it, case closed, stay the course, stay in line. That we might have a question for God like a child, that we might have the freedom to ask a question like Jesus, that we might even have a duke it out session with God like Jacob, is usually not on our radar. But it does say here that Jacob had striven with God, and he came, weird, he came away blessed because of it. So why not us? Why don't we keep on growing and searching? Why don't we keep on growing and searching all of our wayfaring lives? Why not?